I don't know that it's been challenged, but it's definitely discriminatory, and it doesn't make sense. I mean, that's one of the barriers that you mentioned and I've been talking about to the participation of independent candidates and independent parties getting on the ballot. And furthermore, if you have ballot status, you can nominate candidates by convention. So the candidates who are nominated by convention don't even have to collect signatures at all. They can be challenged by other candidates within the party who do collect signatures and force a primary. For example, in the Attorney General's race this year, Andrew Cuomo was nominated by the Democratic Convention, so he didn't have to collect any signatures. And then the people who wished to challenge him in a primary, they had to go out and collect signatures to do so. But the ability to nominate candidates through a primary is another big benefit of the major party status. And then another big advantage that our election law gives to major party candidates in the signature gathering is that it lets the major parties collect their signatures first. The time period for collecting signatures, if you have ballot status, comes before the time period for the independent parties. So they get the first bite at the apple, so to speak. They can go around and approach all the voters, and then after they have collected their signatures, the independent candidates can try to collect signatures. And you're not allowed, a person can only sign one petition. So if someone has signed the petition of another candidate, they can't sign for the independent candidates. So that's an advantage in terms of getting signatures. And then the independent candidates are also disadvantaged because later they have less time to deal with challenges to their petitions and other issues to resolve those disputes and get their names on the ballot. Because we've had different situations where the Green Party candidate, different challenges have run into October, and the boards of elections say, well, we're sorry, we've already printed up the ballots, you know. And that seems to influence how the decisions get made. So there are a lot of disadvantages that independent candidates have under our New York State election laws.
And who made these laws? Was this the legislature or were these agencies that wrote these laws?
The legislature wrote the laws. The State Board of Elections has some regulations interpreting the laws, but the basic laws were written by the state legislature, and they are clearly written to favor the two major parties.
Well, as an attorney general, what remedies would you find in the New York State Constitution to address what seems to be a very discriminatory policy toward people trying to run for public office?
Well, unfortunately, in this regard, our New York State Constitution is not a great deal of help, because in the Constitution it's provided that the Board of Elections in each county and statewide will be composed of representatives of the two top parties on the ballot. So our system for monitoring and regulating elections is an extremely partisan system. Unlike other countries where they have nonpartisan boards administering elections, we have partisan boards, and they are partisan. The two major parties, no third party participates in our Board of Elections. A lot of observers, international observers of our election process, see this as a fundamental flaw of our electoral system here, that we would have partisan bodies overseeing elections. So that's something that needs to be changed at the constitutional level.
To change the Constitution of New York State, are legislators required to do something, or can people approach it directly, bypassing the legislators?
You know, there's a whole procedure for convening a constitutional convention, and that has been done every so often. But definitely the people of New York can call for a constitutional convention. And I think, you know, as people understand more and more about these different issues affecting democracy that we've talked about here, that people, you know, that's something we should do in New York and make our laws more democratic.
We've been talking a lot about the Green Party But not everyone listening may be familiar with the Green Party and what it stands for.
Well, the Green Party grew out of a number of movements of the 1960s and 70s, the environmental movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-nuclear movement, the feminist movement. People in all these movements saw the need for electoral action and saw that they shared a lot of principles and ideals and came together to form the Green Party. The first Green Parties were actually formed in Tasmania and New Zealand in 1972, and the Green Party became very active in Europe in the 1980s. The Green Party started here in the early 1980s. There was a group called the Committees of Correspondence that drafted the 10 key values, and those values were what I read and really inspired me to join the Green Party. And I'll just mention a few of them, but ecological responsibility, concern for the environment, belief in nonviolence, ending war, social and economic justice, and grassroots democracy. And decentralization is another one of the key values that I think interacts with grassroots democracy. Feminism and non-hierarchical approach to things is another value. And the fact that the Green Party stands for these values and not in the interests of the few, the privileged few, means that we have not been bought by those interests. And we're representing the interests, we're trying to represent the interests of everyone. And so as a Green Party Attorney General, I don't have ties to the big developers or the big business interests that the other candidates have ties to. I am free to enforce our laws for the benefit of all. And I don't think the other candidates are free to do that.
You're implying, really, is that the remedies for some of these problems exist on the books, but they're just not being implemented by the people who are holding office, as opposed to, well, we just don't have laws that allow us to do certain things.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying. We have a number of excellent laws. We have our environmental laws. We have our antitrust laws. We have our securities laws, all of which are designed to protect the interests of ordinary people and need to be enforced. I think a lot of the economic problems that we have in this state come from not enforcing our antitrust laws and our securities laws to make a level playing field for that everyone can participate in equally. We talked a little bit before about corruption. I mean, so many aspects of our economic system in this state have been corrupted and turned to the advantage of a few, and that has destroyed our economy. Increased democracy is going to be our best hope of dealing with the great changes that I see coming in our lifetime. And I think that we in the rural part of New York, being closer to the soil and the water, are in a better position to thrive when those changes happen. The people in the large cities are more vulnerable because they are not as close to food production and that sort of thing. Where we can use the resources that we have in this state to build a new economy, I think that the biggest problem here when we're talking about toxic pollution of water and soil and air is our methods of production using toxic chemicals. And we really have to stop using these toxic chemicals. It's often presented as, oh, the environmentalists want to impose these impossible burdens on business by having scrubbers on the smokestack or something. It's not feasible. It's not economic. Well, it's not economic for us to destroy the very things that we need to live on the planet, to destroy our water, to destroy our air, and destroy our soil. This is not economic, and enforcing our environmental laws to require non-toxic methods of production is what we have to do for the future of all life on this planet, and we have to do it soon. The new concerns about global warming, which some people had talked about for a long time, but now seems to be generally accepted that, yes, we have global warming, and it's going to be, it's a huge problem that's going to bring great changes, and we have to do something about it. It seems that there now is more recognition that something has to be done. Well, we have to change our ways of production, and we have to change our ways of producing energy, producing industrial products, and there people have been researching this and developing non-toxic ways of production. It can be done, and it's often much less expensive to do it that way. We just need to put the effort into trying to do it. So I see as Attorney General that enforcing our environmental laws is a way to force an essential change in our methods of production. And it raises the question of why would anyone produce these toxics? And I think it's a real lack of understanding of the consequences of their action. People who are so focused on making the next buck, who haven't been keeping up with environmental issues, who haven't been keeping up with the health studies to see the consequences of their actions. Their health is being affected. Their children's health is being affected. It's affecting everyone's life. It seems so blind to me to keep doing this. You know, a major form of toxic contamination, a major source is war. What we're doing in Iraq, using depleted uranium and the bombs, you know, we are responsible for tremendous toxic destruction in Iraq that's affecting the people of Iraq, that's affecting our own soldiers who are in Iraq, and it's affecting the whole globe because this toxic dust, this radioactive dust, is blowing around the entire globe. I just can't believe that they are aware of the consequences of what they're doing.
Speaking of radioactivity, New York has several potentially deadly nuclear power plants. How would you address this as Attorney General?
I am most familiar with the circumstances of the Indian Point nuclear power plant, and I know that in various ways that plant is violating the law. New York law gives the Attorney General the right to institute a proceeding against a corporation that is repeatedly violating the law to have their corporate charter revoked. And I think that the operation of these radioactive plants is something that calls for a very severe penalty, such as revoking their charter. I think that proceedings need to be brought to address the problems that these plants are causing and to stop it.
How does that stop the plant from creating the problem? In other words, why can't they go forward with the plant even if their charter is revoked?
There is an issue about the successors in interest to the plant. It would really be for the court to decide the remedy that would be allowed. But as Attorney General, I would be seeking to have the corporation put out of business, so to have the corporation dissolved. That would generally be the remedy for a revocation of a corporate charter, would be that the corporation itself would be dissolved, and that would end its operations. You're talking about, you know, could other entities succeed to that? That's possible, but they would need to get relicensed and reapproved and go through the whole regulatory process of scrutiny, who they are, what they're promising to do. So they couldn't, you know, they would have to go through a whole new approval process to take over the plant.
Okay, then meanwhile, there's a plant sitting there, a radioactive, deadly plant filled with radiation and radiation waste. If the corporation is dissolved, then who becomes responsible for that, you know, being the custodian of that mess for the next 500,000 years or whatever is required?
Well, the plants are required to have decommissioning funds, and I'm assuming that that's under the jurisdiction of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would be overseeing how the plant would be decommissioned and handling that. I look forward to the Green Party doing very well in this year's elections. I think we've been getting a lot of support. Concern that people have expressed about the other major party candidates. I think more people are turning to look for alternatives and turning to the Green Party, and I do encourage people to vote for what they believe in this election.
Rachel Treichler, Green Party candidate for New York State Attorney General. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Candidates lined up in a row, time to turn on the camera, start the show. They kiss babies with a tie, tried every soundbite that might fly. But be they congressmen or preachers, the only ones who made the features were those who knew their station. Is that a man or a corporation? Spam and won that round, went on to the big buck battleground. They bought some ads, they bought some more, they got freebies by the score. Hired thugs went door to door, especially if you're black or poor. Said your vote might be against the law, don't tell me the deal is raw. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy. Reported every word uttered by these two old birds as if their tongues were heaven sent. They didn't tell us what was meant, no voting record to analyze, and watch as they feign surprise when history proves to us again the thieving crooks who are these men. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy. Not a word from those dirty commie peacenik nerds. There will be debates, slogans will fly, but only rich men need apply. There's only room up there for two, Tweedledee and Tweedledoo. Uncounted ballots will litter the floor in this banana Republican class war. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy. Said and done, the pundits will say democracy won. Some will cry into their socks, some will sit and watch more Fox, where scandals, wars, and desperation are all the fault of the United Nations, while those who drill the oil, make the tanks, laugh out loud all the way to the banks. We had an election, it ain't no lie, it was the best one money could buy.
Last week, I began reading from Chapter 6 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. The chapter, titled The Lure of Utopia, talks about the goal behind the system of compulsion schooling, the realization of a vision that small groups of elite men had for centuries considered an ideal, society as an orderly hive. Gatto wrote, "Now New England was to take advantage of the chaotic period of heavy immigration and the opportunity of mass regimentation afforded by civil war to establish this form of total state." Close quote. Gatto called this the end of Thomas Jefferson's dream, the final betrayal of democratic promise in the last new world on the planet. In this week's reading, Gatto will examine who put the conformist machinery of the modern state in place and how this was done, in spite of persistent and broad-based resistance to it among the populace, and why, to what ends. And he writes, "The very clear connection between all the zones of the emerging American hive world are a sign of some organized intelligence at work, with some organized end in mind. For those who can read the language of conventional symbolism, the philosophical way being followed represents the extraordinary vision of the learned company of deists who created the country coupled to the Puritan vision as it had been derived from Anglo-Normans, descendants of the Scandinavian French conquerors of England, those families who became the principal settlers of New England. It is careless to say that bad luck, accident, or blind historical forces caused the trap to spring shut on us. Of the various ways an ancient ideal of perfected society can be given life through institutions under the control of the state, one is so startling and has been realized so closely it bears some scrutiny. As the hive world was being hammered out in the United States after 1850, the notion of unique, irreplaceable natural families came increasingly to be seen as the major roadblock in the path of social progress toward the extraordinary vision of a machine-driven utopian paradise. To realize such a theory in practice, families must be on trial with each other constantly and with their neighbors, just as a politician is ever on trial. Families should be conditional entities, not categories absolute. This had to be the operational standard of the Puritan settlement in America, though hardly of any other region, unless the Quaker Pietist sections of the middle colonies who shunned outcasts, even if family. If after testing, an original mother and father did not suit, then children should be removed and transferred to parent surrogates. This is the basis of foster care and adoption. By 1900, through the agency of the radical new Denver-Chicago Children's Court, one important machine to perform this transfer function was in place. Children need not be wasted building blocks for the state's purposes just because their natural parents had been. The lesson the new machine economy was teaching reinforced the spiritual vision of utopians: perfect interchangeability, perfect subordination. People could learn to emulate machines, and by progressive approximations they might ultimately become as reliable as machinery. In a similar vein, men and women were encouraged through easy divorce laws and ever-increasing accessibility to sexually explicit imagery to delay choosing marriage mates. With the mystery removed, the pressure to mate went with it, it was supposed. The new system encouraged trials, trying on different people until a good fit was found. The most surprising thing about the startup of mass public education in mid-19th century Massachusetts is how overwhelmingly parents of all classes soon complained about it. Reports of school committees around 1850 show the greatest single theme of discussion was conflict between the state and the general public on this matter. Resistance was led by the old yeoman class, those families accustomed to taking care of themselves and providing meaning for their own lives. The little town of Barnstable on Cape Cod is exemplary. Its school committee lamented, according to Katz's Irony of Early School Reform, that the, quote, "great defect of our day is the absence of governing or controlling power on the part of parents and the consequent insubordination of children. Our schools are rendered inefficient by the apathy of parents," close quote. Years ago, I was in possession of an old newspaper account which related the use of militia to march recalcitrant children to school there, but I've been unable to locate it again. Nevertheless, even a cursory look for evidence of state violence in bending public will to accept compulsion schooling will be rewarded. Bruce Curtis' book, Building the Education State, 1836 to 1871, documents the intense aversion to schooling which arose across North America. In Anglican Canada, where leadership was uniform, as well as in the United States, where leadership was more divided. Many schools were burned to the ground, and teachers run out of town by angry mobs. When students were kept after school, parents often broke into school to free them. At Saltfleet Township in 1859, a teacher was locked in the schoolhouse by students who, quote, threw mud and mire in his face and all over his clothes, close quote, according to school records, while parents egged them on. At Brantford, Ontario, in 1863, the teacher William Young was assaulted, according to his replacement, to the point that Mr. Young's head, face, and body was, if I understand rightly, pounded literally to jelly. Curtis argues that parent resistance was motivated by a radical transformation in the intentions of school, a change from teaching basic literacy to molding social identity. The first effective American compulsory schooling in the modern era was a reform school movement which know-nothing legislatures of the 1850s put into the hopper along with their radical new adoption law. Objects of reformation were announced as follows: respect for authority, self-control, self-discipline. The properly reformed boy, quote, acquires a fixed character, close quote, one that can be planned for in advance by authority in keeping with the efficiency needs of business and industry. Reform meant the total transformation of character, behavior modification, a complete makeover. By 1857, a few years after stranger adoption was kicked off as a new policy of the state, Boutwell could consider foster parenting, the old designation for adoption, one of the major strategies for the reform of youth, close quote. The first step in the strategy of reform was for the state to become de facto parent of the child. That, according to another Massachusetts educator, Emory Washburn, quote, presents the state in her true relation of a parent seeking out her erring children. The 1850s in Massachusetts marked the beginning of a new epoch in schooling. Washburn triumphantly crowed that these years produced the first occasion in history whereby a state, in the character of a common parent, has undertaken the high and sacred duty of rescuing and restoring her lost children by the influence of the school. Close quote. John Philbrick, Boston school superintendent, said of his growing empire in 1863, "Here is a real home." All schooling, including the reform variety, was to be in imitation of the best family system of organization. This squared with the prevalent belief that delinquency was not caused by external conditions, thus letting industrialists and slumlords off the hook, but by deficient homes. Between 1840 and 1860, male school teachers were cleansed from the Massachusetts system and replaced by women. A variety of methods was used, including the novel one of paying women slightly more than men in order to bring shame into play in chasing men out of the business. Again, the move was part of a well-conceived strategy. Experience teaches that these boys, many of whom never had a mother's affection, need the softening and refining influence which woman alone can give, and we have, wherever practicable, substituted female officers and teachers for those of the other sex. Close quote. A state report noted the frequency with which parents coming to retrieve their own children from reform school were met by news their children had been given away to others through the state's parens patriae power. Quote, "We have felt it to be our duty generally to decline giving them up to their parents and have placed as many of them as we could with farmers and mechanics," close quote, reads a portion of Public Document 20 for the state of Massachusetts, written in 1864. To recreate the feelings of parents on hearing this news is beyond my power. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education.
I'm just driving down this highway, past a shopping mall. I see billboard after billboard, hear the advertisers call. I see cars and I hear cars and I smell cars all just like mine. I see a world covered with asphalt, you're in parking lot G9. Just sprawling on forever, doesn't even have a name. It's a land where everything looks the same. See the signs rise high above us, flashing day and night, Verizon Wireless, Holiday Inn, Coca-Cola Light. There once was grass here, maybe forest, but none of that's here now. It's just product after product, as much as time and space allow. My in Tennessee or Texas, Baltimore or Burlingame, I'm where everything looks the same. Ancient forests, family farmers, or the commons, heart of town. Does it make money? That's the question. If it don't, we'll knock it down. There's not a bicycle for miles, not a soul in sight that can't be seen behind a wheel, a few feet from the headlights. I don't know my neighbors, and I feel ashamed, here where everything looks the same. If you don't like the Walmart, take these drugs, you'll feel okay. Now go sit behind the register and pass your life away. Eat these burgers from the factory, and if you should get fat, just give us some more money, and we've got some drugs for that. In this nation of individuals, is there one that we can blame? Why everything looks the same? I'm driving past the clear cut with the brand new multi-cinema and the massive mural painting, the latest enema. I think of moving eastward, maybe Ghent or Amsterdam, far from Ronald McDonald and his greedy Uncle Sam, where life looks more like life and not some cardboard money game, where everything looks the same.
Three decades later, at the University of Chicago, William Rainey Harper, former Chautauqua Wizard, began a revolution that would change the face of American university education. Harper imported the university system of Germany into the United States, lock, stock, and barrel. Undergraduate teaching was relegated to a form of Chautauqua show business, while research at the graduate level was where prestige academic careers would locate, just as Bacon's New Atlantis had predicted. Harper, following the blueprint suggested by Andrew Carnegie in his powerful Gospel of Wealth essays, said the United States should work toward a unified scheme of education, organized vertically from kindergarten through university, horizontally through voluntary association of colleges, all supplemented by university extension courses available to everyone. Harper wrote in 1902, quote, "The field of education is at the present time in an extremely disorganized condition, but the forces are already in existence to change that. Order will be secured and a great new system established, which may be designated the American system. The important steps to be taken in working out such a system are coordination, specialization, and association." Close quote. Harper and his backers regarded education purely as a commodity. Thorsten Veblen describes Harper's revolution this way, quote, "The underlying businesslike presumption accordingly appears to be that learning is a merchantable commodity to be produced on a piece rate plan, rated, bought, and sold by standard units, measured, counted, and reduced to staple equivalence by impersonal mechanical tests, close quote. Harper believed modern business enterprise represented the highest and best type of human productive activity. He believed business had discovered two cosmic principles, techniques implicit in the larger concept of survival of the fittest, consolidation and specialization. Whatever will not consolidate and specialize must perish, he believed. The conversion of American universities into a system characterized by institutional giantism and specialization was not finished in Harper's lifetime, but went far enough that in the judgment of the New York Sun, quote, hell is open and the lid is off. Harper's other main contribution to the corporatization of U.S. scholarly life was just as profound. He destroyed the lonely vocation of great teacher by trivializing its importance. Research alone, objectively weighed and measured, subject to the surveillance of one's colleagues, would, after Harper, be the sine qua non of university teaching. Promotion of younger men in the departments will depend more largely upon the results of their work as investigators than upon the efficiency of their teaching. In other words, it is proposed to make the work of investigation primary, the work of giving instruction secondary, close quote. Harper was the middleman who introduced the organization and ethics of business into the world of pedagogy. Harper-inspired university experience is now virtually the only ritual of passage into prosperous adulthood in the United States, just as the Carnegie Foundation and Rockefeller's General Education Board willed it to be. Few young men or women are strong enough to survive this passage with their humanity wholly intact. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. And on the point just raised, I suggest the book Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt that takes a similar look at postgraduate education in America, which I read over the air the year before last and can be found in our show archive at unwelcomeguests.org. And continuing with Gatto. In 1932, John Dewey, now elevated to a position as America's most prominent educational voice, heralded the end of what he called the old individualism. Time had come, he said, for a new individualism that recognized the radical transformation that had come in American society. Associations, tightly or loosely organized, more and more define opportunities, choices, and actions of individuals. Death, a staple topic of children's books for hundreds of years, because it poses a central puzzle for all children, nearly vanished as a theme or event after 1916. Children were instructed indirectly that there was no grief. Indeed, an examination of hundreds of those books from the transitional period between 1900 and 1916 reveals that evil no longer had any reality either. There was no evil, only bad attitudes, and those were correctable by training and adjustment therapies. To see how goals of utopian procedure are realized, consider the further sudden change that fell upon the children's book industry between 1890 and 1920. Without explanations or warning, timeless subjects disappeared from the texts, to be replaced by what is best regarded as a political agenda. The suddenness of this change was signaled by many other indications of powerful social forces at work. The phenomenal overnight growth of, quote, research hospitals, where professional hospitality replaced home-style sick care, was one of these, the equally phenomenal sudden enforcement of compulsory schooling, another. Through children's books, older generations announced their values, declare their aspirations, and make bids to socialize the young. Any sudden change in the content of such books must necessarily reflect changes in publisher consciousness, not in the general class of book buyer whose market preferences evolve slowly. What is prized as human achievement can usually be measured by examining children's texts. What is valued in human relationships can be, too. In the 30-year period from 1890 to 1920, the children's book industry became a creator, not a reflector, of values. In any freely competitive situation, this could hardly have happened because the newly aggressive texts would have risked missing the market. The only way such a gamble could be safe was for total change to occur simultaneously among publishers. The insularity and collegiality of children's book publishing allowed it this luxury. One aspect of children's publishing that has remained consistent all the way back to 1721 is the zone where it is produced. Today, as nearly 300 years ago, in the Northeast is where children's literature happens, inside the cities of Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. No industry shift has ever disturbed this cozy arrangement over time. Concentration became even more intense. Philadelphia's role diminished in the 20th century, leaving Boston and New York co-regents at its end. In 1975, 87% of all titles available came from these two former colonial capitals, while in 1876 it had been only 84%, a marvelous durability. For the past 100 years, these two cities have decided what books American children will read. Until 1875, about 75% of all children's titles dealt with some aspect of the future, usually salvation. Over the next 40 years, this idea vanished completely, as Comte and Saint-Simon had strongly advised. The child was to be relieved of concerning itself with the future. The future would be arranged for children and for householders by a new expert class, and the need to do God's will was now considered dangerous superstition by men in charge. Another dramatic switch in children's books had to do with a character's dependence on community to solve problems and to give life meaning. Across the 18th and 19th century, strength afforded by stable community life was an important part of narrative action, but toward the end of the 19th century, a totally new note of self was sounded. Now protagonists became more competent, more in control. Their need for family and communal affirmation disappeared, to be replaced by a new imperative, the quest for certification by legitimate authority. Needs, now suddenly dominant among literary characters, were so-called expressive needs. Exploring, playing, joy, loving, self-actualizing, intriguing against one's own parents. By the early 20th century, a solid majority of all children's books focus on the individual child free from the web of family and community. This model had been established by the Horatio Alger books in the second half of the 19th century. Now, with some savage modern flourishes, like encouraging active indifference to family, it came to totally dominate the children's book business. Children were invited to divide their interests from those of their families and to concentrate on private concerns. A few alarmed critical voices saw this as a strategy of divide and conquer, a means to separate children from family so they could be more easily molded into new social designs. In the words of Mary Lystad, the biographer of children's literary history from whom I have drawn heavily in this analysis, quote, "As the 20th century continued, book characters were provided more and more opportunities to pay attention to themselves. More and more characters were allowed to look inward to their own needs and desires." Close quote. This change of emphasis was managed at the expense of others in the family group, she adds. From 1796 to 1855, 18% of all children's books were constructed around the idea of conformity to some adult norm. But by 1896, emphasis on conformity had tripled. This took place in the 30 years following the Civil War. Did the elimination of the southern pole of our national dialectic have anything to do with that? Yes, everything, I think. With tension between northern and southern ways of life and politics resolved permanently in favor of the North, the way was clear for triumphant American orthodoxy to seize the entire field. The huge increase in conformist themes rose even more as we entered the 20th century and has remained at an elevated level through the decades since. What is most deceptive in trying to fix this characteristic conformity is the introduction of an apparently libertarian note of free choice into the narrative equation. Modern characters are encouraged to self-start and to proceed on what appears to be an independent course. But upon closer inspection, the course is always toward a centrally prescribed social goal, never toward personal solutions to life's dilemmas. Freedom of choice in this formulation arises from the feeling that you have freedom, not from its actual possession. Thus, social planners get the best of both worlds, a large measure of control without any kicking at the traces. In modern business circles, such a style of oversight is known as management by objectives. Another aspect of this particular brand of regulation is that book characters are being shown being innovative, but innovative only in the way they arrive at the same destination. Their emotional needs for self-expression are met harmlessly in this way, without any risk to social machinery. Much evidence of centralized tinkering within the factory of children's literature exists, pointing in the direction of what might be called unit man, people as work units, partially broken free of human community, who can be moved about efficiently in various social experiments. William Rainey Harper, president of the University of Chicago, thought of such an end as laboratory research aimed at designing a rational utopia. To mention just a few other radical changes in children's book content between 1890 and 1920, school credentials replace experience as the goal book characters work toward, and child labor becomes a label of condemnation in spite of its ancient function as the quickest, most reliable way to human independence. The way, in fact, taken by Carnegie, Rockefeller, and many others, who were now apparently quite anxious to put a stop to it. Children are not encouraged to work at all until their late teen years, sometimes not until their late 30s. A case for the general superiority of youth working instead of idly sitting around in school confinement is often made prior to 1900, but never heard again in children's books after 1916. The universality of this silence is the notable thing, deafening, in fact. Protagonist goals in the new literature, while apparently individualistic, are almost always found being pursued through social institutions, those ubiquitous associations of John Dewey. Never through family efforts. Families are portrayed as good-natured dormitory arrangements or affectionate manager-employee relationships, but emotional commitment to family life is noticeably ignored. Significant family undertakings like starting a farm or teaching each other how to view life from a multi-age perspective are so rare that the few exceptions stand out like monad knocks above a broad, flat plain. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The three most influential books ever published in North America, setting aside the Bible and the New England Primer, were all published in the years of the utopian transformation of America, which gave us government schooling. Uncle Tom's Cabin or Life Among the Lowly, 1852, a book which testifies to the ancient obsession of English-speaking elites with the salvation of the underclasses. And Ben-Hur, 1880, a book illustrating the Christian belief that Jews can eventually be made to see the light of reason and converted. And the last, A Pure Utopia, Looking Backwards, 1888, still in print more than 100 years later, translated into 30 languages. In 1944, three American intellectuals, Charles Beard, John Dewey, and Edward Weeks, interviewed separately, proclaimed Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards, second only to Marx Das Kapital, as the most influential book of modern times. Within 3 years of its publication, 165 Bellamy clubs sprouted up. In the next 12 years, no less than 46 other utopian novels became bestsellers. Was it civil war, chaos, decades of mass immigration, or a frightening series of bloody national labor strikes shattering our class-free myths that made the public ready for stories of a better tomorrow? Whatever the cause or causes, the flowering communities of actual American utopianism took on real shape in the 19th century, from famous ones like Owenite communities and Fourierian Falanistres, or perfectionist sexual stews like Oneida, right down to little-known oddities like Mordecai Noah's Ararat, a city of refuge for Jews. First they happened, then they were echoed in print, not the reverse. Nothing in the human social record matches the outburst of purely American longings for something better in community life. The account recorded in deeds and words in the first full century of our nationhood. What Bellamy's book uncovered in middle-class, upper-middle-class consciousness was revealing. The society he describes is a totally organized society. All means of production are in the hands of state parent surrogates. The conditions of well-behaved, middle-class childhood are recreated on a corporate scale in these early utopias. Society in Bellamy's ideal future has limited the reality of democracy. Citizens are answerable to commands of industrial officers. Little room remains for self-initiative. The state regulates all public activities, owns the means of production. Individuals are transformed into a unit directed by bureaucrats. Eric Fromm thought Bellamy had missed the strong similarities between corporate socialism and corporate capitalism, that both converge eventually in goals of industrialization, that both are societies run by a managerial class and professional politicians, both thoroughly materialistic in outlook, both organize human masses into a centralized system, into large, hierarchically arranged employment pods, into mass political parties. In both, alienated corporate man, well-fed, well-clothed, well-entertained, is governed by bureaucrats. Governing has no goals beyond this. At the end of history, men are not slaves, but robots. This is the vision of utopia, seen complete. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. How could the amazing lives of George Washington, Andrew Jackson, the John D. Rockefellers, Margaret Fuller, Amy Lowell, my own immigrant McManuses, Gattos, Zimmers, Hoffmans, and D'Agostinos have added up to this lifeless utopia? Like a black hole it grew, although no human being flourishes under such a regime, or rest easily inside the logic of hundreds of systems intermeshing into one master system, all demanding obedience from their human parts. Here is a materialistic inverse of Ezekiel's spiritual vision of wheels within wheels. In a New York Times description of the first Edison Project school in Sherman, Texas, a system of proprietary schools supplying a home computer for every child, email, longer days and years, and the most high-tech school in America, as Benno Schmidt, former president of Yale, put it, The local superintendent gloated over what he must have regarded as the final solution to the student control issue. Can you imagine what this means if you're homesick? The teacher can just put stuff in the student's email. There's no place to hide anymore. Have I made too much of this? What on earth is wrong with wanting to help people, even institutionalizing the helping urge so it becomes more reliable? Just this. The helping equation is not as simple as utopians imagined. I remember the shock I felt on many occasions when my well-meant intercession into obvious problems a kid was having were met with some variation of the angry cry, "Leave me alone," as if my assistance would actually have made things worse. It was baffling how often that happened, and I was a well-liked teacher. Is it possible that there are hills that nature or God demands we climb alone or become forever the less for having been carried over them? The plans of true believers for our lives may well be better than our own when judged against some abstract official standard. But to deny people their personal struggles is to render existence absurd. What are we left with then besides some unspeakable Chautauqua? A liar's world, which promises that only if the rules are followed, good lives will ensue. Inconvenience, discomfort, hurt, defeat, and tragedy are inevitable accompaniments of our time on earth. We learn to manage trouble by managing trouble, not by turning our burden over to another. Think of the mutilated spirit that the victims of overprotective parents carry long after they are grown and gone from home. What should make you suspicious about school is its relentless compulsion. Why should this rich, brawling, utterly successful nation ever have needed to resort to compulsion to push people into school classes, unless advocates of forced schooling were driven by peculiar philosophical beliefs not commonly shared? Another thing should concern you: that the consequences of orthodox mass schooling have never been fully thought through. To show you what I mean, consider the example of Sir Humphrey Davy, inventor of the coal mine safety lamp, after an 1812 explosion in which 92 boys and men were killed. Davy's assignment to the honor roll of saintliness came from his assertion that the sole object of his concern was to serve the cause of humanity, a declaration made credible by his refusal to patent the device. Let nobody deny that the safety lamp decreased the danger of explosion relative to older methods of illumination. But the brutal fact is that many more miners died because of Davy's invention. It allowed the coal industry to grow rapidly, bringing vastly more men into the mines than before, opening deeper tunnels, exposing miners to mortal dangers, which fire damp is only one, dangers for which there is no protection. Davy's safety lamp brought safety only in the most ironic sense. It was a profit enhancement lamp, most of all. Its most prominent effect was to allow the growth of industry, a blessing to some, a curse to others, but far from an unambiguous good, because it wasted many more lives than it saved. Serving the cause of humanity through forced government schooling may also turn out to be a stranger matter than it appears, another Davy lamp in a different costume. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 6, The Lure of Utopias, from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. This book was the result of 10 years of research into the roots and outcomes of our educational system. John Taylor Gatto was a public school teacher in New York City for 30 years. He resigned in 1991 after concluding that schooling was not increasing but decreasing our intellectual capacity. And he embarked on a project to find out why. He has since become one of the nation's most vocal proponents of homeschooling and self-directed education. You can find out more about his work at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. That's spelled GATTO.com, where you can also download this book in its entirety for free. And you can download MP3s and podcasts of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.